Welcome to another episode of New Books and Poetry. I am your host, John Ebersol, and I am delighted to be joined by none other than Don Scher. Don, welcome.
Great to be on here. It's great to see a fellow podcaster at work, John.
Oh, well, thank you. Your podcast is amazing. And we were talking a little before we started recording your experience about podcasting, and I wanted to jump on that. Could you go back a little and tell the listeners about how your podcast kind of came about?
Yeah, well, you know, not too long after I came to Poetry Magazine, I realized that, you know, Chris and I would talk back and forth about submissions, about poems, about books we were reading. And they had some other podcasts at the time at the Poetry Foundation. I thought, well, why don't we have a podcast? And, of course, Chris is kind of reticent in many ways, you know, and he's not looking for public attention and stuff. And so I think he was a little reluctant to do it, but I was pretty enthusiastic about it, and we didn't know what to do. So I just said, well, why don't we just talk on the podcast the way we actually speak to each other, like people, you know? And I think he was a little dubious about it. And
right.
We had no idea if anybody wanted to hear such a thing or how to do it. And we had some good help from our producer, Curtis Fox, who has great ears. And, mm-hmm. you know, we just set the microphone up basically at a table in the office and started talking. And in the early days, we'd have to shut the thing off. We were on Michigan Avenue in Chicago. We had to shut it off every time there was a siren.
Oh, that's funny.
Every 8 or 9 to start over. You know, but that was the gist of it, was we, you know, from that day to this on the podcast, you know, we just talk. And,
yeah.
And it's pretty on the fly.
It really is a joy to listen to. And I'm wondering, is there, now that you guys, you know, have been doing it for a while, where do you record the podcast now? Is it still at the Poetry Foundation? Do you guys have a beautiful studio now?
Well, you know, in the old days, we didn't have anything, sort of a table, you know?
Yeah.
And since then, we've moved in, you know, to the new building in Chicago. And there's a tiny little, it's technically what you would call a studio,
sure.
But it's kind of like the size of a closet, maybe.
Exactly.
And it's really the same deal. So there's a table with, two microphones on it. Now we have two microphones. But really the main improvement is it's soundproof, so we can sort of continue speaking to each other without having to turn the machinery on and off every couple of minutes.
Exactly. And do you ever, are most of your guests over the telephone, or have they ever come in person?
Most of them are on the phone.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, we recently had a Scottish poet, and so we were able to do that by having her go into a local radio studio, and we often do that and wire everything up together. Sometimes there's a bit of sleight of hand, but yeah, so, you know, we call people up or do it any way we can, and if they're around, sure, we'll fit them into the closet with us.
Yeah, no, it's really enjoyable to listen to. You brought up Christian Wyman, and, you know, there's been things since you took over at Poetry Magazine. There's little, and I've even kind of sensed it. I've been unable, I don't know, I'm trying to put my finger on it, but people are starting to pick up like, wow, there's this like entirely new vibe at Poetry Magazine since you took over for Christian. I was wondering if you could think about what was it that Christian brought to the table that you were like, I definitely want to maybe keep that intact, and maybe things that, you know, that you want to kind of follow your own vision about things. Because I always say this because people have started like, there's definitely this different vibe, but I don't know if I could put a finger on it. I'm not quite sure exactly what it is. Can you talk to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty much what people would guess it is. I mean, the first thing I guess Chris brought to the table was me. I mean, you know, he'd been editing the magazine on his own for a couple of, you know, for a few years.
Right.
And then, you know, he brought me into the mix. And I think when, you know, I'd never met him before and didn't know anything about him, you know, until, you know, we started talking about my working there.
Yeah.
And what we realized was that in a lot of ways, our kind of inclinations and tastes and the way we do things were different, like completely different.
Oh, wow.
I like to say complementary.
Sure.
But at the same time, we just hit it off. Even though, you know, we were so completely different in a lot of ways, we just sort of, like, you know, in other ways, just sort of able to work well together, improbably enough. And so that kind of fueled a joint editorship that was very successful.
Right.
So that from 2007 until Chris left last year, it was kind of, you know, a joint project. And, you know, the sort of creative and constructive tension between us resulted in the magazine in that incarnation.
Right.
And it was a little bit, I mean, I think Chris probably would cringe if he heard this. But to me, it was a bit like a marriage. You know,
sure.
If you don't have to be the same as the person that you're in a relationship with, it's often better if you're not.
Right.
You know? And so you bring different strengths to the mixture. And I think we enjoyed that. And I think our readers did too. When I took over, it was kind of like, well, that, you know, we've done that,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so now what you see is kind of what it's like somebody like me turned loose.
Yeah. This is you separated.
Yeah. Yeah, it's sort of like, yeah, when people split up,
yeah.
you know, people go a little wild there for a while. So,
yeah.
So this is like my wild years, maybe. I don't know.
Right.
But it is different. And, you know, I think then, too, that, you know, rather than have something just go stale and predictable, you know, the magazine, you know, needed refreshing.
Yeah.
The vision is pretty much the same, but the substance of it is in texture and other things about the magazine over time as things unfold. You know, yeah, they'll be different. And,
yeah.
That's the fun of it. But also I think, you know, it's a responsibility I have.
No, definitely. And I think it's moving in the right direction. And it's funny how you said, Christian was sort of like, when he cringed about the podcast, I could see that he is almost absent on social media where you are like have a presence now.
Right.
And
right.
So it's very, I sometimes think that your social media presence adds to, whether accurately or not, kind of a perception of the magazine in a way that you're, that I don't know, that you somehow have your finger dug into the pulse of things.
Gouging them.
Yeah, you're like stabbing it. And so, you know, when we look at the table of contents, we see familiar names, but we also see kind of a generation of poets that haven't gotten a lot of attention in the pages of poetry. And I think that people are really, I mean, everyone I talk to is really kind of excited about the direction. So so that is really great.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, you know, it's a funny thing. I often think about this when I first started sending poems out. To places like Poetry Magazine, first of all, the odds that you would meet or even know or be in the same place as you know, sort of a editor of a magazine like Poetry or Paris Review, you know, the odds were small. You would send poems off. It's a black box kind of a process. You wouldn't
wow.
know who was doing what and what was going on in that place and what they were thinking. And, mm-hmm. you know, and you know, really a commitment of mine since I came to Poetry was to change that because there's real people reading the magazine. There's real people editing it and producing it. There are obviously, you know, the poets are sending their work. And we're all kind of, you know, together in this process, the readers, writers, and editors. And so I feel like I just enjoy making that a very transparent process. You know, if somebody says something on social media, but I mean, I'm there, you know,
yeah,
the poem, I'm reading it, I'm thinking about it. And John, that's actually kind of how you and I have met. I mean, we've never actually met in person,
right.
But we have met and we're working, you know, both as writers and people who do sort of editorial work. I mean, there's no sense pretending that we're somehow oddly unaware that we're all coexisting.
I was really thinking about that too. I have to give a little shout out to my sister-in-law who got me on Twitter, and she's like, "You really need to do this. I think you would enjoy it," or whatever. And it has been a real big revelation. I never thought of it as a genuine kind of community of maybe not entirely like-minded people, but people interested in the same things. And it has really opened my eyes, and I will never underestimate its power. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I was also going to say, you know, you also hear what people don't like and what they're unhappy with.
It's true.
And I think that's important, too. I mean, there's no sense pretending, you know, a poem or an essay or review goes out into the world and you hear about it. But I like hearing about it, and I think it's good for editors to know what people think, just as much as I think it's important for them to know their own minds and have their own directions, you know, that in a way is not necessarily swayed by some kind of, you know, momentary popular, opinion. You know, you have to be kind of aware of the immediate impact while at the same time realizing you have a much longer horizon of responsibility than what people think the month an issue appears, say. I mean, because people might, be reading, hopefully, some of this work 100 years from now or something. So you have to sort of balance all these things. But I find it energizing. I mean, I really do. And I've met some of the most incredible poets through social media.
I have as well. It's really incredible. That is just, I never envisioned it at all. It's funny that you brought up the idea that poems will, and I was just thinking about this the other day, poems that will last 100 years. And I started thinking, like, in the debates between conceptualism and like disposable text, right, and all that jazz, that we had this idea that we want poems to withstand the test of time. And I thought, and I agree with that sensibility completely, while I know probably more people with a more maybe experimental ethos could care less about that, maybe. I don't know. But,
the thing about that is it's not a simple linear thing. So, for instance, the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, as everybody must get tired of hearing, was in Poetry Magazine almost 100 years ago. And the maximum number of readers it could have had at the time was, 300. I mean, there weren't a zillion subscribers or readers.
That's incredible to think
at that time. But over time, it's not so much that Prufrock was built to stand the test of time. We don't know what the hell it was built for.
Right.
It just happened to. And what happens now is over the lifespan of a piece of work like Prufrock, there are millions of readers. But nobody did that. Nobody calculated that. Nobody was engineering that. That's just sort of how it happens. So
I think that is very illuminating, because I think sometimes – I don't know, maybe it's myself. I put some like ridiculous pressure on myself at times, like looking at the poem I'm writing and going, oh my God, this is horrible. You're like, like this gets like, I don't know. It can't, I do feel at times that pressure of, writing a poem that somehow endures. And I think what you're saying is I have absolutely no control over that.
In a way, you don't. I mean, you know, again, just using Prufrock as an example, yeah, when that was published, I mean, they got hate mail at Poetry Magazine. People said it wasn't a poem. All the stuff people will say now,
right,
100 years ago, it's not a poem. You know, the guy's a psychopath. To the psychopathic ward was what Louis Untermeyer said. He's like a very famous critic and
yes,
poet and anthologist. You know, it caused a lot of trouble. It's just like in the February issue of Poetry, we have this long piece by Matea Harvey.
Uh-huh.
And people are going to say it's not poetry.
Right.
I mean, you can tell they're going to say that.
Yeah.
They've been saying it forever, and they'll say it again. As to what it is and what it means and if it's good or not good, I mean, that kind of gets sorted out.
Really,
but it gets sorted out in a very different process than sort of the day-to-day debates that we engage in.
Yeah, that's really true. I was talking to, when I interviewed James Loggenbach, he was saying exactly the same thing. And I remember being like liberated by this idea. Like when you're writing, that poem is going to just behave in the world as it's going to behave with almost little control that you have. And that should be, in fact, very liberating instead of feeling crushed by current taste when you're composing your poems. I want to kind of back up into your biography. I keep seeing that you were born and raised in Memphis. And
well, I wasn't born there, but raised there.
Right, you were born in Ohio, is that right?
I was born in Ohio. And you know, Robert Frost is from San Francisco, but people, rightly feel that he was a New Englander. So that's kind of the distinction there. I mean, I was born in one place, but really came from another. And the place I came from is Memphis.
Well, I've never been there. I know it's a great music town, but how was your childhood, and what was your family life like?
I'd have to go to a shrink to discuss that.
I don't mess around, Don.
just tell me when my time is up and send me the bill. I mean, my family, I don't know. I mean, there was, let me put it this way. You know, Memphis is a distinctive place, although it is partly Southern. It's more mid-Southern. But beyond that, it is a quirky and idiosyncratic place. Mm-hmm. And the best book I know of that describes it, to my mind, accurately and reflects my own generation is Robert Gordon's book, It Came from Memphis.
Uh-huh.
You had, you know, Alex Chilton, William Eggleston, Furry Lewis. I mean, there was just a lot of stuff swirling around, a lot of, you know, obviously Stax and all that kind of stuff, plus the things going on in the 60s and 70s, you know, that were swirling around. But one of the great things about Memphis was that everybody is a character.
Yeah.
And it's not really, it isn't done on purpose. People don't realize that they're characters. So there's something Faulknerian about it. You know, that people turn into these very striking personalities without, you know, having done that on purpose. So there is also an element of surprise and, more importantly, a sense that, like, nobody obeys the rules.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of Elvis-y, you know. I mean,
yeah.
People don't obey the rules because they don't know what they are. There aren't any rules. There's just, like, you know, sort of a haze and a swirl.
Well, that sounds like a great environment for an
it was
kid
pretty
to
good. It was pretty good. I mean, I think if you were like me and my friends and you were interested in music or, whatever sort of creative stuff kids do, or you play in a band, which I also did, you were kind of at odds from day one with this sort of dominant sorts of social structure. So that's not a bad thing. I mean, it sort of strengthens you and it gives you an ambition to sort of break out, you know,
yeah.
Sort of get out of town. And so when I was about 17, I got out of town.
And where did you get out of town to?
Well, it was something we thought about, you know, although I loved it there and glad I grew up there, you know, you're always kind of thinking, how can I get out of here? How can I get out of here? And so I was saying this to some friend of mine who was a lot smarter than I was, and he pointed out that a very good way to get out of town is, like, to go to college someplace else.
Yes.
So there it was a question of, like, where to go. And actually, for a long time, I wanted to go to Chicago, and I had a poster of Chicago on my bedroom
That's
wall
it.
Because, well, the nearest big city, pardon me, St. Louis, but
yes.
When I was a kid, you'd either go to Chicago, as a lot of people did. There were great migrations of people for generations from Memphis up to Chicago, or you'd go to New Orleans. But my friend, he said, well, let's go to New York, you know.
Oh, man.
Great. How do we do that? So we applied to schools in New York, and so next thing you know, there we are in New York in the 70s. It was great. That was great, too.
So how do you – you must have been pretty solid inside, because it seems that you survived the 70s in New York City. And where did you go to school there, and what was that experience like?
Well, it's kind of funny because I didn't make very good grades in high school.
Yeah.
I was sort of screwing around, getting in trouble, you know, thrown out and mm-hmm. all that stuff. But my smart friend had applied to Columbia University, and so I said, okay, I'll do that, too. Not sort of realizing, you know, you had to have good grades. So in the application materials, you had to write an essay and provide a reading list. Well, when I was getting in trouble, they would send me for punishment to the high school library.
Oh, my.
And they had all these great classics because no one ever read them. They just sent me to, you know, this is like going to jail or not. It wasn't like, I'm sorry, you should expunge it. It wasn't like going to jail.
Right.
But it was where I went for punishment. And I pulled a book off the shelf, and it was called Crime and Punishment. And I thought, well, that suits my situation, you know. And it's a great story about, like, you know, bashing the landlord's head in. And
yeah.
I thought, wow, this is a good book. And next thing you know, unwittingly, I was reading really good books. Plus, my mom was a librarian. And she would drop me, you know, off at the library and just turn me loose there. So the next thing you know, I'm reading all this cool stuff, and I just dumped all that. I was reading, like, Oswald Spengler as a teenager. It's like, whoa. So I put all this stuff on the application,
that's
and I think they sort of liked that. But in the essay, they wanted you to talk about what you're reading, and I said, well, I'm reading Sahara of the Bozart by H.L. Mencken.
Oh, my God.
So, and then I put a little cassette tape of my bad music that I had written.
Really?
And they let me in. So when I get in, and I'm in New York, we went out for a beer, and one of the guys on the admissions team was there, and he said to me, you know, we took a pretty big chance on you. Because they could have filled the class with people from New York, you know, but they liked that I was from Tennessee.
Right.
And they got a big laugh out of my application. They enjoyed the unintentional comedy of my essay and stuff. And so they said, well, we'll take the guy. And for the first time in my life, I started making really good grades because I thought, if they kick me out of here, it's back to the South
right.
I go.
Oh, my God.
So I buckled down.
Exactly. And when did you slow – is that when you kind of – I don't know, like kind of poetry found you when you started kind of reading it seriously. When do you think that occurred?
Well, I'll tell you, I was not an English major.
Mm-hmm.
I started taking classes with Elaine Pagels, and I became a religious studies major.
Hmm.
And I was reading all these great ancient Near Eastern texts, and
right.
biblical texts. And I was just completely absorbed in this and had a big crush on Elaine Pagels, you know. Now at the time, Columbia was an all male school.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a girlfriend who was at Brown, and I used to go visit up there, and that was co-ed, and everybody looked so normal and happy. So I transferred up there, and when I got there, there was a comp lit class I took. And on the reading list for this class were things, there was a lot of stuff, but it had Charles Olson and Pound and Eliot's Four Quartets and
oh, wow.
all kinds of great modernist stuff and Williams and Patterson, you know. And suddenly, you know, I'd grown up in Memphis. They didn't have any poets in Memphis at that time. So I thought a poet was a guy with a long gray beard who's probably dead, you know.
Yeah.
But shortly, right before I went off to New York with my friend, Allen Ginsberg came to town. It was the first time I'd ever seen a poet.
Wow.
He started off with the harmonium, you know, and
sure.
the ohm for 20 minutes.
Definitely.
And I thought, that's very cool. That's very interesting. So between seeing Ginsberg, and then a couple of years later, you know, really reading these great, modern poetry books, I just said, this is it. You know, I just love this. I stayed a religious studies major, but that experience of poetry for me really did it. Just opened up a whole world that they never taught us about before.
That's incredible. And your impulse to kind of take that religious track, was that kind of born out of family experience? Or what do you think that was all about?
I think it was because of the crush on Elaine Pagels, but also... Well, because you know, we were reading these, what are now known because of her as the Gnostic Gospels, and
right.
so the sense that there were these whole civilizations they don't sort of tell you about in high school or Sunday school for that matter.
Yeah,
just these immense, you know, these immense sprawling civilizations with all the kinds of mysterious texts. That go along with them.
Yeah.
I became really fascinated with that. The reading that is very much like reading modernist poetry.
Mm.
You have to sort of situate yourself and really work at it. And I enjoyed that. So I became interested in, you know, myth and poetry and anthropology, which is a pretty trendy thing to do at that time anyway. But really, the ancient Near East was just so... absorbing to think about that's what I studied when I was studying.
Definitely. How long were you in New York after you got you went to Brown and you were in
yeah,
Rhode Island.
I went up to, that's right.
How did you find the transition from New York City to like a more New England setting? Because I really like Rhode Island.
Well, New York is great, you know, but I didn't have any money, and I think it's still true today
mm-hmm.
that, you know, if you're in New York and you have no money, it's kind of, it's not that much fun. It could be actually quite hard.
Yes.
And I was very naive When I first got to New York, I was meeting these other kids, and they were all from the same two towns, Andover and Exeter. And I couldn't understand it. I said, why are you guys all from the same place? Prep school. I'd never heard of a prep school. I said,
right.
What the heck is that? So New York was great, and I had a blast, but it was a hard place to be for me, you know, just coming from, you know, where I was coming from. It was a bit more than I could deal with. And then Rhode Island, although it's totally different from Memphis, it has the same kind of aura, which is that there's a lot of strange and interesting things going on, and the place looks a little weird, and, you know, people are kind of off doing idiosyncratic things. And so, you know, I liked Providence a lot. And I stayed there for a few years after college, and I did the thing you're not supposed to do, like I married my high school sweetheart, and
yeah.
We were 21 or whatever.
Wow.
You know, made a lot of significant errors.
Yes.
At that time.
How long were you? How long were you guys married?
Around. Well, we stayed married for like 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
But then what? one day she came home and. Geez, I hope she's not listening to this. Nah, she's not listening. You know, it's sort of like she was going to medical school, and, you know, and I was one of those sort of liberal arts people who was like, I don't know what I'm doing. You know, I still am in a way. And, you know, she kind of said one day, you know, I think we should have a separation.
Right.
And I said, like, well, like for how long? And she's like, you know, forever.
Oh, God.
So that phase eventually ended. I mean, that by that time, we'd lived in Texas for a while, and we ended up in Boston. And I was in Boston for 21 years. So I was there for I was in Boston for more of my life, really, than anywhere else.
Yeah, oh, my gosh. So 15 years. And, I mean, how did that impact your own writing, you think? That's a significant partnership to be in for a while, and to have that narrative suddenly split off like that.
That's a good question. I mean, you know, there's a tendency, I think, if you're a writer or a musician or, you know, sort of an artsy person,
yeah.
You know, you want to go where the stuff is. So you think of places like New York, San Francisco, you know. But what I found was that when I was in places like Texas or Rhode Island, I could do a lot because there weren't that many people doing the same thing that I was doing.
Right.
You know, so I saw that, you know, you can feel like you kind of own it. Like, I'm here and nobody gets what I'm doing. And I had all kinds of jobs, you know, and people would just think if they knew that I was interested in writing or poetry, they would just think, well, that's, isn't that cute? You know, that's nice. John reads all those books no one's read before in the library. And they sort of thought, well, that's great. And so I had jobs where you could read kind of on your own or think of some thoughts or go home and write. And it was great. It was great. But when I got to Boston,
and what year,
you know, you go and get a cup of coffee and everybody in there is writing in a notebook.
Right. What year?
Like, hey, wait a second. I'm the only one who's doing this. Nope. So it was harder. I think it was harder for me. You know, you got a sense of, I mean, it was nice to have bookstores and go to readings and meet people who are doing it. But in your heart of hearts, you kind of, you know, there was a hothouse mentality that I think could be hard for lots of people. It was hard for me, that's for sure.
Yeah. What year did you get to Boston?
1986.
86. You ended up being curator at Woodbury around 2000. What are you doing for those years in between before you got the job at Harvard?
Oh, man.
Do I even want to know?
I had a lot of weird jobs.
So were you just like working weird jobs, cranking out poetry when you could?
Yeah, sure. For a long time, I worked in libraries because that's a very handy way to read a lot of books, especially poetry, because in most libraries, the poetry books are still on the shelf. You know, they don't get checked out frequently.
That's so true.
So my first sort of real job, $8,000 a year, I worked in a library, And sort of, because I wasn't an English major, I was reading a lot of stuff, but I didn't know what I was doing. So I just kind of read from the A's to the Z's.
Oh, that's great.
And I didn't know, you know, well, like, there were people, okay, Yeats, like, I knew he was that would be a good poetry. But, I mean, I was reading all kinds of poets without necessarily realizing, you know, what their reputations were. And that was a good thing. That was a really good thing. And I had a lot of time, so I read through all that stuff. And I had other jobs. I for a while, I worked at a community college. I worked at a junior college. At one point, I was driving a truck between the campuses of a junior college. And, you know, they would just, you know, fill up the van in the morning and take off. And they were like, as long as I came back with the truck and hadn't had an accident, they were cool. So I could read and do all that stuff. It was great. It was really great.
I like these jobs where you made sure, like, I think, and I was attracted to the same type of jobs where kind of solitary, but kept you moving, involved chances to read. it's so funny how many writers find the same type of jobs. But you were about to say something.
Well, yeah, because I mean, after a while, I was very directionless, you know, and most of the people I knew, they like knew like what they were going to do, you know, with their lives. And I was sort of drifting. And at some point, I just thought, well, I don't know. I'll have to really, you know, sort of get people to mentor me a little bit. And, when I was like 29, I guess, I was working again in the library part time and I thought, well, maybe I should go to one of these, writing programs. So I ended up in the writing program at Boston University where, I had great teachers, Derek Walcott,
sounds
George
nice.
Starbuck, Christopher Ricks, William Arrowsmith, really great mentors, you know. And
when you went into that,
sorry
to interrupt, were you kind of locked into poetry at that point?
Oh, well, I thought I was, yeah.
Okay.
I pretty much was.
All right.
I wasn't sure what I was going to do. Because I was older than the other people in the workshop, they were all, like, mostly out of college, you know, right out of college. And they were just going to, they wanted teaching jobs, whereas it never occurred to me. Like, I didn't realize you would do that. I thought you'd go to a writing program and still be essentially the same sort of hapless person at the end of it than before.
Like?
And all these guys were, like, looking at teaching jobs, and I thought, well, I don't know if I can do that. I didn't realize it. So, you know, I just thought, well, I'm still going to be kicking around, but, you know, these mentors are great. Like, I'm really learning a lot. I mean, they were kicking my ass and getting me to sort of straighten up and be serious. Because it's hard to take yourself seriously when you're sort of working these jobs and getting nowhere and you're nobody and sending work out and, you know, it's hard, right? So I then did, I became pretty serious. I thought, no, this is the thing I've got to do. And in that same first year that I was in Boston, I just sort of waltzed in to the Office of Partisan Review offering my services, which were non-existent, really. And I think they looked at me and were just appalled. What's this apparition?
What
happened? So I said, I'll do anything. I'll do anything.
Yeah.
And I stayed there for about 18 years. I mean, not as a full-time, it wasn't a job really or a full-time thing, but I really started doing, like putting books on the shelf and hiding when the real editors came, typing up letters, sometimes answering the phone. And over time, I learned everything about how a literary magazine works.
Oh,
you know, from A to Z, from beginning to end. And that's where I really was sort of educated about editorial work.
And what a place to get an education. Oh, my gosh. That's amazing.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, it's sad, really, because, you know, it was killed off. And it's largely forgotten now, I think, except by sort of literary scholars.
Right.
But it was a great magazine then at sort of the end of its life. And the editors had become kind of weird.
What do you mean?
They become sort of neoconservative people, but the poetry section was, you know, still held in some esteem, and the poetry editor was Rosanna Warren, and I mm-hmm. became her assistant, and then she taught me, you know, just all kinds of wonderful things about how to do that work, and I got the hang of it, I guess. You know, I started off, one of my jobs there was early on, I would have to make notes on submissions, you know.
Really?
It's just sort of, because they had this very complex structure of readers. They had first readers, second readers, third readers, and then the editors. And so things would go up this ladder on these rungs, you know. And I was the guy at the very bottom. So I did this for years. And I eventually I thought, well, nobody's reading these little slips of paper, you know. Oh. So I thought, well, I'll just say what I really think.
Yeah.
You know, so poems would come in, I'd say what I really think. The dilemma was, if you passed up the ladder too much stuff, they would smack you down because they would say, look, not everything you're sending us is good.
Yeah.
So cut it out. But
yeah.
if you never sent anything, they would figure out you were worthless because what were you doing down there?
Right.
So you had to get it right. And but I just assumed, well, I'm nobody. So I started just writing little essays on all the submissions.
That's awesome.
And after a couple of years of this, the editors called me to the office. I thought they were going to throw me out. And they had a bunch of these slips on the desk.
Oh,
I thought,
God.
Oh, no. They were reading. And William Phillips said, well, you know, we've been reading these comments you've been writing. I thought, oh, no.
Here we go.
Big trouble. And, you know, he sort of very reluctantly said, you know, it seems like you know what you're doing. You know, it seems like you have a good eye.
Right.
So now we want you to do like more serious editorial work. And he hastily added, you know, that this new responsibility and 50 cents would not buy me a cup of coffee. That was my introduction to editorial work. This is largely true for many years.
That is incredible.
So they gave me a chance, and then, you know, I worked very hard at that and still kept my other jobs going and,
yeah.
you know, with going to school and working and doing all this stuff. And then eventually I sort of, you know, people, I think, realized that I was able to do this editorial work, that I had learned a lot about poetry from kicking around and reading it and sort of educating myself. And the thing about Harvard was it was, honestly, it was kind of a fluke. I don't know why they hired me.
I'm totally convinced that. Tell me you're working on like a book of personal essays about this stuff. It is really fascinating because you've kind of exercised this perseverance. And I think it's interesting, too, because you I don't know what you ended up getting your degree in, but I find it really interesting that you didn't get it in English, because I think that allowed you to come to poetry and literature from an angle that was probably beneficial. And then you had that like light bulb moment in Boston where you're like, I got to start taking myself seriously. And then things started kind of like mysteriously falling into place. And so you got to Harvard, and what happened there?
Well, I was the poetry editor for Harvard Review, but also the curator of poetry. Yes. Working in the Woodbury Poetry Room. And my job was to, acquire books, poetry books for Harvard, and take care of that collection and add to it. And I created their first project to digitize and preserve poetry audio, because they had a great audio archive that was disintegrating.
Oh, wow.
Old tapes and discs. So I came up with that. And, you know, I was there for 7 years and very happy. It was a great... It's like a dream job for a poetry writer.
I know. You're just probably like pinching yourself like all the time.
Every day.
And tell me about
every single day.
Why, you know, you're kind of, it sounds like, you know, things are starting to really kind of crystallize professionally. What's going on with your poetry? Your first book has already come out. Is that right?
You know, my first book was actually a book of translations of poetry.
Mm-hmm.
The Miguel Hernandez I started because when I was a teenager, lonely in New York, I was hanging out in the sort of dark corners of the library. And I had taken Spanish in high school and just started reading poems in Spanish without, again, without really knowing sort of what it was I was doing or who to read. And I stumbled on Hernandez, and I, you know, started mentioning him to a lot of people, and they didn't really know him.
Yeah.
So for myself and for them, I would translate these poems, and people would say, oh, these are great poems. And I was still doing that off and on. And Derek Walcott sort of, he sort of didn't like my own poems at first. That was his pedagogical method, was to sort of break you down.
Right.
And so, you know, it's like, well, what else are you doing?
Yeah.
So I'm translating these other poems that are like better than mine.
Oh, wow.
And he looked at them and he said, you know, you should really keep doing that. You should translate those. You should do that. You should work on that. And again, it was a thing where I didn't really know how seriously I should take it. And he said, no, you should do this. So I did that. And that set me off in that direction so that in 1997, my first book was really these translated poems of Miguel Hernandez from Blood Axe.
Yeah.
And around that time, too, I edited a book called Seneca in English for Penguin Classics.
Yeah, that
was... My first books were not books of my own poems.
I think that is so interesting. What did the experience of translating do for you as you, you know, just approached your own poetry?
You know, a lot of people naturally ask about this.
Yeah.
And they assume that I have some affinity with a poet or poets that I've translated. But I don't. Miguel Hernandez was a very courageous guy. He only lived to be 31, but you know, he got caught up in the Spanish Civil War and endured great hardship, poverty, and disease, and eventually was given a death sentence by Franco. Although they didn't execute him, his health deteriorated in Franco's prisons, and he died there as a young poet. So for me, there's nobody more different for me than a Miguel Hernandez.
Hmm.
So actually what's happening there is that his work, again, this is, you know, it's funny, I never thought about it till now, but it's sort of like what we were talking about with Chris Wyman. The difference between me and this other poet was the field of creative work.
Right.
It's just this courageousness, this nobility, this involvement in a world that I can only imagine.
Right.
And can't even really imagine.
Sure.
Was what really got me going and really just created a place in my own imagination where a kind of passion was able to come through in the translations. If I related to him, you know, like, so, you know, on some very personal level and said, yeah, you know, we're the same, you know, we're just, you know, we're kindred spirits, it would have been a bore. I mean, the results would have been boring.
I think that's right. You seem
my own.
You have a pattern of putting yourself into kind of healthy antagonisms, it seems like.
Yes, because I think it comes from a kind of thinking about literature that Empson articulated. I didn't know Empson as a young person, but he has said that really the purpose of creative literature is to come into contact with people who have different values than you do.
Right.
You know, that is actually the value of what we're doing with things like poetry. And I guess I instinctively always felt that way. I mean, again, growing up in a place where there's a lot of different things happening, different kinds of music, different races, different political viewpoints, is actually a constructive and strengthening aspect of our own culture. It's a good thing. And we benefit from it. In a way, I was lucky all along to find very few people who sort of liked what I liked or thought what I thought, because
right.
You had to really work at what you were doing to get anywhere. Otherwise, you'd just be hanging around. Everybody would be going, yeah, I love Frank O'Hara. You know,
exactly.
Yeah, I love, you know, whoever it is. It's very easy. And there's nothing wrong with it. It's just that it didn't happen for me that way.
No, and I think there's a huge benefit to that. I think I agree with that in the sense of, like, when I see poetry or criticism or poetic theory that kind of intuitively strikes me as like, oh, wow, I don't share that, it does simultaneously force me to evaluate and reevaluate my own literary values. That's really great. So past the translations, your work, how do you see, because we're going to read, you know, from Wishbone today. I'm wondering how your work, as you see it through Union, Squandermania to Wishbone, where do you see kind of your trajectory as a poet? Did you, you know, I don't know if it was Logan or William Logan, who's like talking about like a poet by their second or third book is kind of like settles in. And I don't think he meant it in a bad way, just kind of like totally, you know, pitches it in. No, you know, kind of finds their voice, their style, and their kind of, you know, where do you see your trajectory as a poet? And I want to get back too, because I like what you're saying about kind of this kind of cultural component, because when I read your work, and it's something I admire so much because I have a hard time doing it, you are so open to importing the historical moment, you know, and the cultural moment into your poems, and it never dilutes it or traps it into kind of a time frame. But how have you seen your work kind of change over time?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I mean, I really appreciate what you've just said, because I think that again, that's a strengthening thing. You know, I'm not really writing about myself or some character who is myself, but we all actually do. I mean, we live in this historical and cultural moment. There's no sense denying it. But as we do so, most of us are ordinary people, and right. We have ordinary shit going on. You know, we get married, we split up,
yeah.
You know, or what, you know, day-to-day stuff is not on a different plane from the political stuff and historical things that we're implicated in and participate in, or maybe some people also choose to kind of ignore, but you can't. So that the great things happening that you read about, I mean, by great, I don't mean good. I mean, like, the larger things that transpire around us, which right. are history in the making every day.
Yeah.
They impinge upon our personal relationships. They create the atmosphere in which we connect with each other or fight with each other, or, you know, good as well as terrible things unfold every hour, every moment. And so I just feel like, you know, the poems I write get caught in that, you know, that kind of mesh.
Yeah.
It's just a part of it, you know. And so now the thing about what William Logan says is interesting, because that may be true if you're well known as a poet. So that if you're, I'm not going to use any names as examples,
sure.
but, you know, a well-known poet, it's unlikely that somebody's going to say, you know, like, this one's okay, that was, you know, this one's no good, that, you know, like, nobody's going to edit a famous poet too terribly much.
Right.
You know, because presumably they know what they're doing and they're succeeding at it and they have a readership and people like it. And that being the case, there probably is a tendency to sort of work from the things that have worked for you before with some modifications. But I've never really gotten anywhere as a poet. I don't have that problem. So for me, you know, if there's a book of poems, it, you know, it really isn't under the shadow of any previous accomplishment, because for better or worse, I don't have that. So I don't have, there's no poet who's me that I have to live up to
that
or,
so
you know, deal with in any way.
So
there's a freedom there.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you find that you write very different poems or that you
yeah.
just are not constrained, like, oh God, I got to satisfy this, like, expectation, you know?
Well, my first book was sort of, you know, the structure of the poems was in a certain way intricate. I was not a formal or formalist poet, but I did, you know, if you look at books like Derek Walcott's Midsummer, where there's, you know, the sounds and lines and words have definite relationships to each other.
Yes.
The patterns, music-like patterns emerge without, like, a lot of calculation beforehand
right.
or afterwards. That sort of made a big impression on me. So my first book was kind of, I think when you're, you know, working on the poems that turn into some kind of a vision of a first book, you're trying to be very, very, I don't know, you know, you're trying to be good
at yeah.
what you do. So I was trying to be good. And my first book came out from Zoo Press, which
yeah.
as soon as that book came out, the press imploded.
And they were a pretty infamous press, actually. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, they kind of,
yeah.
like, I didn't know. That's crazy. So right when the book came out?
Yeah. So I was sort of stymied for a while. You can imagine, it's so exciting. You have a book. It's what you've wanted, and there it is. And then next thing you know, it's like it might as well not have existed. So I thought, well, first of all, I don't want to do the same thing all the time. Few of us really do. And there was no point in it. It's not as if I had a first book with a reputation to live up to, or, I can see where if a lot of people buy a book, it's Delmar Schwartz syndrome.
Right.
He has a book and he's praised by the great poets of his time. And then the question is, oh God, now what? What am I going to do? I'll do what I did before. That worked okay. No. So I didn't have, I didn't have any of that to worry about. So
right. In
Squandermania, I just thought, I have no choice. I'm just going to write as me, And at that time, it was right when September 11th had happened.
Yeah.
There was a lot of sort of rhetoric, political rhetoric, that caused most of us, I think, even to this day, that, you question, okay, somebody is saying this, but do they really mean what those words are saying?
Right.
So I was caught up, like all of us were, in a world where, the sort of standard articulations of things were not right.
No, that's so true.
Something that just didn't make sense,
It's weird historical moments kind of boil over its own lexicon in a way and changes. It forces us to, hear that language in a way that's disturbing. It's really interesting.
I mean, I was living in Boston, and Boston had a connection to the events of September 11th, as everybody knows. And, when they would go on TV and they would say, we fight the terrorists abroad so we don't have to fight them at home.
Right.
I was trying to make a home for myself, and I kept thinking, the home I thought, sort of American way of life, home.
Yeah.
Oh, you get, maybe I'll have a house, and a kid, and all that stuff. And you just think, well, they're saying that the terrorists are going to be running down my street.
Right.
We better fight them over there because they're going to be, And so I was struggling, and I talked to my folks, and, my folks had lived through the Depression and World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, if we thought like you do, you wouldn't even be here.
Right. Exactly.
So there was a kind of sense that in the poems that I was working on for Squandermania, that you had to emerge from this welter, that you had to, there were a lot of questions, but that you couldn't just ask questions, and you couldn't just be dubious, and you couldn't be afraid, and you couldn't be cynical. You had to do something, and you had to do things that were right, but there was no way to know what that might be. And there was no way to fit it into the larger scheme where all these things were happening that you had no control over. So, Squandermania was, I didn't make up that word because I would never make up a word. It's just me. It's a word that was used in things like The Economist magazine. And it's pretty much what you think. It's just like you take something that there's a lot of and you just piss it away.
My God.
So I was very interested in the sort of, the profligate uses of our everyday language, which were being kind of emptied out.
Yeah, no.
Ways. Plus our material squandermanias. I mean, these are all common places. In other words, these are not big ideas I'm having. They are, in fact, the opposite. I was confronting the stuff that everybody says, that everybody thinks about. We all think stuff like this. And I was just thinking, well, to me, that's the subject of poetry.
Yeah. It's a beautiful title. And it almost, there's a hint of acidity to it that gives it kind of a bite, it has a little bit of I'm pissed off to it too,
Well, I was very, I was very angry. I think a lot of people were. There was a lot of tension, a lot of uncertainty, and sort of being afraid, under the pressure of these larger circumstances, mostly political and economic, people do get, they go bullshit. Yeah. I mean, that's happening every, it's ridiculous to even say it. But I thought, you know, it's funny. This is sort of how that book came about, because after the death of my first book, I was about ready to give up, you know. But I did a reading at the bookstore in Amherst, the Amherst bookstore, and I had some of these poems. I kind of thought they were angry poems, and I was reading them, and people were laughing. I thought it was really, you know, sort of pounding the, you know, the podium with my fist rhetorically. And everybody was laughing. And so I asked somebody, I said, why are people laughing? I was so angry. You know, I was a sort of amorphously angry person in these poems. And people were laughing their asses off. And I think it was my friend John Hennessy who said, it is funny. And I thought, you know, there is a kind of humanity in that. So, yeah, there was a bite and also a kind of a sense of the irredeemable comedy of it. And I thought, well, I guess I'll go with that. That's what I've got. I don't have anything else. You know? And so that's where that was.
Yeah, it's really steeped out of that time. And how do you see kind of, how did Wishbone come about? And how do you think it kind of responded to the world when Wishbone came out? I mean, you're still locked into the cultural moment. Now that kind of 2011, September 11th, kind of the epicenter of that and what it did to everyone. And now you kind of, it's almost like it's a weird echo of that time. You know, I'll ask students sometimes, like, and I love asking them, like, where they were on September 11th. And they keep getting younger, you know, like sixth grade, fifth grade. I'm like, wow, that was like one of the most central historical events of my lifetime. And it's starting to even be kind of like my memory is being squandered of that event. Because of,
right.
You know, so I'm wondering, like, Wishbone has a graveness to it that at least the title Squandermania doesn't seem to have in a way.
Well, I mean, so for Wishbone, what I realized was, again, these are commonplaces. I'm not putting them forward as like brilliant perceptions. It's the opposite of that. That's what we all know, is there's all this mobility. We move around. We're connected with people all the time, literally and figuratively and electronically and metaphysically. We're just connected, and we never disconnect, and we move geographically. And we sort of wander around our cities, our towns, our houses and neighborhoods, and we're sort of on the move, but like, where are we moving to? And you know, you don't have to know. There's a sense of movement, and part of that movement is the movement of ideology, so that there are different political beliefs, there are religious beliefs, and they're swirling around us. Yet when you read sort of the news accounts or, you know, everything seems, black and white or reified or clear in a way that everybody knows isn't so.
Right.
If you have clarity, it's because you believe something and you don't believe what other people believe if they are different from you. Going back to that Empson thing. So for me, Wishbone was kind of a way of, you know, sort of being in transit further through my life. And during the time I was working on those poems, I mean, you know, there were people in my family who were sick or dying.
Right.
All this sort of, again, usual turmoil that we all, you know, nothing special about it. But that this, you know, I read a lot of poetry, obviously. I mean, it could be that I read more poetry than almost anybody.
I think so.
Because we read all the submissions of poetry. You know, it's just me and Christina and Lindsay, and we read everything, 120,000 poems a year.
Yeah.
So I read poetry, and there's a kind of tone or register in a lot of poems that doesn't mirror the way I know people think.
Yeah.
And Derek Walcott said something very interesting to me back when he was slamming me. He said, "You're more interesting when you talk than you are in your poems." It was a devastating lesson. So for me, from that day to this, I've always become very attentive to that disconnection, even, you know, not only in myself, but everywhere. So sometimes, you know, I meet so many poets, and then I think, is their work as at least as interesting as they are as people, as human beings.
Right.
That to me is sort of a test, you know. So unfortunately, I mean, I don't belong to, nor would I, and in my job, I can't sort of be affiliated with or even sort of intimately sympathetic with any particular school of poetry. I mean, I'm a magpie.
I think this bears
I'm a
collective,
whatever you want to call it. I sort of move around, a jackdaw, I don't know, a brickler. I mean, a lot of us, it sounds pretentious because we who write poems are forced to become pretentious in that activity to some extent. I mean, you brave that risk and try to surmount it if you're any good. But the truth is, I don't, you know, there was no school or particular kind of poetry to which I could gravitate personally.
Yeah.
So, I just sort of got stuck sounding pretty much like what I sound like.
I think that's great, and it's something I think so many poets, including myself, have struggled with, is that I'm kind of very egalitarian in my taste. I know how to appreciate various types of poetry, yet for whatever reason, at the end of the day, I write my poems. You know, like, I'm always struck by that between my own sensibility as writing a poem, as I write a poem, while also having the ability and generosity to see all kinds of modes of composition. And it sounds like, and I think you talked about this with Squandermania, that you just decided, I got to just sound like myself. I got to be myself. And
yet it's not, you know, and this is very much what you're saying. And yet it isn't, as they say, about me. So the more I,
Right.
Another great piece of advice I got as a young poet was, I was trying to be clever, you know, like we all are at that stage. And, somebody said, look, you got to read Ben Jonson, because read all of it, because all of his poems, because he was witty, but you can't imitate him. But you can't make, you know, so it's almost like an education, a deep education in poetry is what allows you to be yourself. You can't just be yourself without being informed by something or a lot of things. And the more I read, the more I could sort of figure out what would be, okay, there's no sense imitating Emily Dickinson. There's no sense imitating Seamus Heaney. There's no sense imitating Kenny Goldsmith.
Yeah. Right.
There's just no, so in the end, you read to discover what's left over for you to do.
Right.
And the more you read, the more you sort of figure out, well, this is my little thing over here, because I'm well aware that all these other things have been done by people who will do them better than you. My old teacher, George Starbuck, also taught me this. It was great. I don't know. I wrote some poem and brought it in to him, and he read it very carefully.
Yeah.
Very silent.
Yeah.
Staring at the page, stroking his chin. And he's a very quiet guy, usually. And he said, this is a very good poem. This is a very good poem. But I know of a better one on the same subject.
Right.
It's called Frosted Midnight by Coleridge. I was like, oh, shit.
I'll talk to you later, man.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, the stakes are very high.
Yeah.
So it's not just, I'm writing the way I write. You have to know what that is. You have to know what it's worth, if anything. You have to know what it means. You have to know the things to do that have been done better so that you don't sort of churn out weak, worthless imitations of what someone else has really done, you know, past the point of our imagining.
Oh, that is great. Let's go ahead and hear some of these poems and crack open Wishbone, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So
with all that buildup, people will realize how modest, and I'm not being silly about that, I mean, how modest my claims are for my own work. I do not...
No,
I don't go around thinking I'm this terrific poet.
I think people are going to, especially younger poets, I think are really going to love what you just said. I think it's really going to clarify some things for them. And it's interesting I did want to ask you, because when you were talking about personal experience, you know, you're quick to demote it as nothing special. I don't think you're saying when you have these human experiences in your personal life, you just shrug and blow them off and be like, hey, look, you know, everyone does this. You know, like, so at some point in your poetry, you do talk about the personal, but like you said earlier, it is always meshed in that which is larger than your personal experience. And I think that is like one of the true strengths of your poetry is the meshing. I loved when you said that, because that's exactly how I felt your poems felt. They felt meshed with the lived world and you in it. So that was really, really a beautiful way to put it, a meshing. So you're welcome. So I sent you a little list, because
yep.
I was a little dictator about it. but I was hoping you could go ahead and read on page 41 the gospel truth. And if there's anything you want to say about it before you read, feel free to.
Well, you know, I'll just preface it by saying in Squandermania, I put all these notes because the welter of information that was so interesting to me became literally hysterical and was part of the squandering and the squandering. And then people were always say, I mean, you know, it's like, that's just too much.
Right.
So in this book, I don't have any notes really. There's no, you know, the sources are just the things that surround us. And that includes books, you know, that we're all reading and chattering away about in social media. So there are things that underwrite these and little bits taken from them.
Sure.
So there's not much explanation to do, because the explanation would, like, sink the boat of the poem, maybe, which is as it should be. But anyway, this is the gospel truth. St. Matthew did not know that mites live in our eyelashes, or he'd not have indicted us for our motes and beams. Every character in my name, a mark of resolves. Notwithstanding, all I have is a forlorn inclination, but even that seems to be bent. The strips of insulation in the attic hang down, flayed and torn. We need a new border and ought to poison the chickweed before it goes dormant. Where is he, meanwhile, who will save us, wound in his side? The one who knows is off on another job, collecting taxes, impervious to the indignity of having been reborn.
Oh, that is great. Thanks for reading that. It made me think when you were talking about your time studying with Derek Walcott, the idea that when he said, it's so amazing, he said, like, you know, you talk a lot better than
Here's and, proof, you just heard it.
And really, like, I think this poem, like, really could have gotten away from you in the kind of level of diction, but it never does. But that he also, and I think you were talking about his book Midsummer or whatever, that you learn from that this kind of the embrace to preserve the musicality and to also achieve your kind of genuine speaking voice. And I think that's really, like, the book, reading this is a mark of maturity, in the sense that a lot of times I read poets who embrace the conversational tone and that music vanishes. And yet if we look through this poem, I mean, we have forlorn, you know, torn, border, dormant, all those OR sounds. It's really, really gorgeous, all these kind of internal music. And I think, I don't know if you would agree, but when that happens, it seems to happen mysteriously, especially with those internal rhymes seem to, rarely in my experience are they like big time kind of word choice premeditated. Do you find that like all these internal rhymes kind of seem to generate and blossom on their own as you compose? It's really.
They really do. They really do. You know, that's why for me, you know, we don't hear so much about it now, but there used to be all this struggle between sort of formalists and, you know, sort of people who are open field kind of people, you could say. And I don't experience any of that. I think you put it better than I ever could. I think if you're you're sort of reading and listening and thinking and sort of, you know, muttering to yourself or singing in the shower. Yeah, those sounds, they come and they blossom, and they're there. They're there in the language everywhere. And it's just a matter of, you know, letting them in. I think when people start manhandling their poems and, you know, tugging on one end of the thread, you know, they risk losing a kind of music because they're worried about what sense it will make or what, you know, they're worried about what people will think,
right,
which is good. I mean, you know, you should worry about that. But I think there's a kind of self-consciousness that I have tried to expunge from that process.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have anything, you know, it's a kind of negative capability. I don't have designs upon anybody.
Right.
I do hear, you know, the sounds and the words that we use. And when they come, I snare them, you know, if I can.
Yeah.
You know, the goal, anyway.
I think you do, definitely. And it's funny that you brought up your humor earlier. And I think being that humor almost derives from that attentiveness to the sound of language. I'm still kind of teasing that out. But a lot of times, I don't know if this is true for you, but I had this poem that's coming out later, and it's taking forever to get published because that's just the pace things are happening. So I'll go back to it to be like, what is this? Let me look at it with fresh eyes. And I will actually catch these internal rhymes or whatever that I didn't even know when I like submitted the thing. It's really, I don't know. It's just one of the joys, I guess, of composing poems. And this poem is, you have, I notice, and it's amazing that for me, you have kind of Lowell's kind of dark energy, and yet you don't kind of make language into a complete wrought iron fence either.
Right.
And I think that it's just, you know, it just reminded me of how, like, you keep reading, and you kind of, like, you know, just the way one develops. I found that your poems in this book are just, you know, they feel like just spot on, like, you've arrived at something. But some of these line breaks, the one who knows is off on another job, there's connotations throughout this poem.
I'm laughing because I sort of feel almost, you know, I feel guilty about it in a way. I mean, it's a little neat, you know, it's sort of a mixture, you know, because, I mean, what oppressed Lowell was that Lowell had such a richness of you know, reference points.
Right.
You know, he had just, he's a guy who, I mean, he was obviously sort of mentally ill anyway, but I think his knowledge fueled his illness.
Right.
And he could lose control of his life, but also his poems at times. And so, I mean, I think you're right. Lowell is there's a great kind of energy, and it is a dark energy. But I mean, obviously, you know, if you, you know, Starbuck used to hang around, and he was, you know, classmates with Anne Sexton, right, and Sylvia Plath, you know, and he sort of deeply taught us, like, this kind of tragic, this romance of the tragic is not good for your work. It's sort of Eileen Simpson Poets in Their Youth stuff, you know, because we all still, you know, read, talk about, many of us love, you know, Berryman and all. And but the thing is, you can't go where those guys went,
right,
and it's not good for you. So you have to sort of stay within the reaches of your own ability and sanity.
I think that's a really great plan, but I think you're knocking on those doors when you write, you know, the strips of insulation in the attic hang down, flayed and torn. I mean, that's just gorgeous. It really is amazing. And, you know, the gospel truth, I noticed in the book that maybe you kind of turn back to gaze at your kind of, your religious impulse. This one who knows is off on another job. And I just thought, oh, this is somebody off on another job, you know, like,
yeah,
it's like, oh, well, he's going to go torture someone else.
Well, we were talking, you know, just as we were talking about, there is, I mean, it isn't entirely a pun, but I mean, you know, the suffering of a job is as enriching as and necessary as any other kind of suffering.
Yeah.
But what was important to me there, although that was part of it was really that, you know, Matthew had a job. St. Matthew had a job.
Right.
I mean, that was his job, collecting taxes. And it's a fascinating thing, you know, so that it sort of brings an aspect of the Christian religious tradition back where it belongs, which is to earth.
I know, that is really good.
You might have a job that involves this, that, the other thing, and it might be suffering, or it might be a path through something else.
Right.
Redemption, I don't know, something else.
Yeah, and the,
something that you're aiming at anyway.
Definitely. And that he did not know that mites live in our eyelashes. It's just, I love.
Well, the thing is, you know, Matthew was so severe. I mean, that was the thing, is that, you know, who can live up to this?
Right.
To me, one of the mysteries is not like a metaphysical mystery exactly, or right. a mystery of redemption. The mystery is why are these strictures so hard on us? You
right.
know, why do we go wrong? Why are we wrong all the time?
It is incredible.
Like you get a mote in your eye or a beam.
Yeah.
I mean, who wants that? I mean, nobody does that on purpose. So to remove it, it's not, you know, why is it a moral question? It's an instinct to remove it.
Right.
So why should we be wrong as sinners? But we feel we are anyway, so there you go.
So there you go. So the next poem I was going to have you read is The Man Who Walks Like Me on page 49.
Right. The Man Who Walks Like Me. Now that my father isn't around anymore, I'm the guy at home who has to look old. I saw a guy just like him limping around. I limp around, too. Shaking out the sheets of her newspaper on the plane, an elderly woman who annoyed the hell out of me in the adjacent booth of my lone, dumb sorrow. She harrumphed like a nightingale who sings, then sends you the bill. Meanwhile, it's still light out. It's still day. I denounce my own day. Then I walk out just like the man who walks like me. I studied him hard, but the body is no scientist.
Thank you so much, Don. That was great. You know, it was funny, when I just heard you read this, when she harumphed like a nightingale, it was, and then that sent you the bill. It was, it made me kind of think of your experience in Amherst and people laugh, because I think I laughed at its accuracy, that that things that strike us true make us laugh. And so, I don't know.
You know, it's the thing about now. There is a reference I should, or a source I should, which is the nightingale who sings who sends you the bill. I think it's from Artie Shaw, who was talking about a singer. You know, Artie Shaw's
sure.
big band. He had a lot of female singers, and
right.
he knew, you know, a lot of musicians, and that's how he. I think he described somebody kind of nastily using a version of that wording.
That was great. And, you know, you mentioned your father. Does he find his way into your poetry a lot?
You know, it's a funny thing. When you're sort of a younger poet, you always look around and you say, you know, if I get married, I'm not writing about being married in my poems. You know, I'm not that icky. I'm not doing
that. Right.
And, you know, like you say, somebody has a kid. You say, if I have a kid, I'm not writing about that in my poems, you know. And it's like, I'm not writing about my father. If somebody dies, and, you know, there's this whole thing, right?
Right.
Against the lyric, which is like, oh, if I see another poem with somebody's father dying in it or a grandfather, you know, if I see another poem like that, I'm going to puke. You know?
Right.
You just hear this every minute of the day.
Definitely.
And you tell yourself that, I'm not going to do that. Well, let me tell people who haven't experienced it, if you become a father or a mother, you will write about it.
Right.
If somebody dies close to you, you can have great notions and beliefs about the value or the lack of value of lyric poetry, as it's sort of stigmatized today, or confessional poetry, another
right.
term of abuse. But it's going to get in there for most of us, and there's no point in shutting it out. I tried to shut it out. I mean, you know, when my old man died, I just said, well, this is my personal thing. That's kind of, it doesn't make psychological sense to say this great thing, this great kind of milestone
right.
occurred, and I'm going to ignore it.
I totally agree with you.
I'm not even
going
to pay any attention to it in my poems will never know that this happened. Well, I just don't know how to do that.
Well, it was so funny. I tell this story kind of a lot because it scarred me when I was at Columbia doing the MFA, and Richard Howard told me this story that he was, you know, a young man at the time, and he was sitting in proximity to Auden and listening to Anne Sexton read, and and it was about a poem about her, like, grandmother or something. And, I mean, this could be told a myth. I have no idea. But he told me he heard Auden, like, lean over to somebody and said, who gives a shit about Anne Sexton's grandmother? And when I heard that story, I almost, like, died. I was like, I will never write my grandmother ever. I will not write about – and I think you're still right that, like –
Yeah, but remember, Auden's the guy who wrote, you know, Lay Your Sleepy Head, My Love, you know? And come on. So Auden, that was a great remark. Auden's a big remarker. But look at his poems.
It doesn't make any sense.
They're filled with his, you know, his family life, his personal relationships.
Exactly.
It's filled with them. Look at New Year Letter. It's just one person he knows after another. You could say, well, who cares if he knew Erica Mann and
exactly.
You know, was going to marry her. But the point is, a poem can make you care, even
right.
when people say they're not going to.
Right. And
you know, the poem overcomes resistance. You could say a poem is an instrument to overcome resistance.
I love
if
that.
If it's good enough.
Yeah, I've read interviews with poets who, kind of in their younger careers, have been known to be kind of experimental, or you know what I'm talking about.
And
I'll see in interviews where either their publisher will kind of characterize their latest work this way, or they will themselves in an interview. But it'll be like they'll start – like their personal life is encroaching on their newer work as they got older. And it's kind of like this big kind of – this is the most personal they've ever gotten. You know, kind of like they're making some deal with the devil almost. Or
yeah.
Like it was a big artistic decision for them. And I like,
right.
And
well, here's the way I look at it, though. You see, like, I didn't say anything about my father. I didn't
right.
say what his name was or what he did. I mean, I snuck something in about him that is just for my thing. But the point is, it isn't even about my father. I mean, many of us lose somebody. A lot of us will lose or had lost our father. So, again, it's not just like my little sad day, you know. It's just everybody goes through a certain kind of experience. And so the poems reflect that or are educated by that in some way. I mean, it's at the back of our basic human experience, whether we care or not or want to write about it or not, it's still there anyway. I mean, it's just sort of the elephant in the living room for many
right.
of us.
Yeah, and I like how you say that, you know, it'll like that stuff, those milestones in your personal life encroach in your poetry because there is something about intrinsic to poetry that makes you want to kind of wrestle with those things in verse. So,
yeah.
I really
at the same time, I didn't want to beat anybody up with my You know, my grief is not interesting. You know, so the poem doesn't cry. You know, the poem isn't crying or weeping or anything. It's just,
But it took
into account something that was part of the world in which it was being scribbled. So.
Right, and I think it goes back to the whole idea of meshing in your work. I think it makes perfect sense. I think it really does. So let's turn to Fantasia on the Rapture, which is just an unbelievably
right.
accomplished poem on page 79.
Well, I appreciate that. Sure. Let me see here. Fantasia on the Rapture. You know that part of a movie where it's almost over, but not quite, and you're glad? Well, that is where I am with life. The horror of just being a line or being contracted into a line that shatters into a thousand aberrations. I could not even retreat dead into emotion, so measure my life in occupations and recycling instead. I have learned to dissemble, Moonflare. And if I had any real gumption, I'd machine gun that great big collected poems of so-and-so. We have come, Yeats was told by the unknown writer, to give you metaphors for poetry. Like him, my wife tells me, I have been engaged in bouts of snoring, of sleeps, of dreams with sounds, hallucinations, scents, flashes of light, and movements of external objects, namely mosquitoes and cats. On whose esoteric authority are we to accept all this rapture? Isn't it all just a hearty bit of temps perdu? I eat, pray, leave. I asked for some TLC, but all I got was the Learning Channel. Well, life is nothing if not educational, cultural, crapital, absolute Titus. I don't believe that an individual is the result of a crowd of a million divided by a million. And I don't believe in pinning you down like a butterfly or know how many stars should be in the evening sky before we start to pray. But I do know that affliction most do give us eyes to see.
Don, thanks. That was great. There's so much going on in this poem. It's really been really just been a delight to go through this book the last couple of weeks. And again, your language, you have such a great way of cunningly referring to the historical. At first, when I was like, measure my life in occupations and recycling instead, I was like, yeah, occupations, you know, like jobs. And then I was like, oh, also the behavior of empires.
That's right. Well, that's it. That's it in a nutshell. I mean, it's like, you know, just when you think you're going about your internal private business, what you are doing is participating in the workings, obviously, of the whole, of everything.
Right. And that is just, it's really incredible because, yeah, to measure my life and occupy, and then, and trusting intuitively language to kind of lead you there into flowering those meanings. It's so great. How does this poem come about?
well, you know, it was sort of, you can tell, I mean, it's a bit of a mishmash. I mean, it's a kind of distraction that you feel when you're sort of down and out. I mean, you get distracted and it's hard to concentrate and all this stuff is going on. And if you're trying to write poems, you worry about what can I be doing? And you're always aware of the big collected poems of so-and-so. You know,
so
these
great.
Sort of things hover around heavily.
I love
you know.
That.
And so... So at the time, you know, I was interested in how, I mean, Yeats, who's the most sort of dramatic as well as melodramatic of poets, was so, you know, got so hung up in automatic writing. I mean, because that's sort of antithetical to what Yeats really is known for.
I know that whole period is crazy if you think about it.
Yeah. And the sleeps I mentioned, that's...
I was wondering about
Yeats.
That.
That's right out of Yeats. You know, these... The unknown writers, you know, these presences who would come to Yeats when they were doing the automatic writing, Yeats and his wife.
Yeah.
And he, according to Yeats, these presences came to give him metaphors for poetry, which I just love.
I love it.
Somebody had to give Yeats some metaphors. Oh, it's these weird automatic writing spirits. So I love that. And one of the things that happens in the automatic writing is the words are spelled kind of funny.
Yeah.
And sleeps is spelled SLEAS. And it looks sort of like apnea is about to unfurl.
I was
spelling
that
way.
That was so funny.
So that's the snoring. It's sort of a, like you're saying, it blossomed into the sleeps, which, you know, I think, again, you reach an age or something and you start snoring. And to me, it's sort of the vocalization of inchoate. Sort of accumulated angst.
That is hilarious.
And I was just trying to put that back in poems, you know. And so for this was kind of, it wasn't automatic writing. But, you know, there was a kind of rapture that I was aiming toward. I mean, I was thinking about that. Like, we think of rapture as being like up in the sky, up in heaven. It's about to descend upon us and do something to us. And everybody's waiting. Like, when is it going to come?
Right.
And meanwhile, we're sort of snoring, sleeping through life.
Oh, that is
so, recycling everything. You know, what are we doing? Well, I'll take the recycling out, and you know, who knows if I'll get back in.
Yeah,
to the house, you know.
No, I think you nailed it completely with, and then the hearty bit of it's temps perdu. Is that right?
Temps perdu. It's like it's like lost time. It's like, you know, the Proustian.
Oh my God!
Like the thing.
I love
the thing we lose. It's time.
That is great. Oh my gosh! So. This affliction, too, at the end just killed me. When pinning you down like a butt, oh, gosh. There's so much going on in the end here, too. I don't know why I thought the crowd of a million divided by a million, and I don't believe in pinning you down, that million pinning. And then,
yeah.
And then they kind of, and then it kind of scatters. You bring the reader's eye, you kind of drag it like a computer cursor right up to the sky. How, you know, how many stars should be in the evening sky before we start to pray? That is just heartbreaking. It's really a beautiful poem.
Thank you. Yeah. No, it's like, what do we have to do to get some rapture around here?
Yeah.
You know, when do we do it? What do we do?
And I want to tweet about it when it comes.
Yeah, exactly. That's how we'll know.
That's how we'll know. So the
million tweets.
That is hilarious. Oh, God. The last poem I'm going to have you read and take us out on is called Looking Over My Shoulder.
Right. Well, this one's, I think, clearer, doesn't need much explanation. I'm so tempted to say it's a true story, but, you know, like poets always want to say, this really happened. But I don't know if this sort of happened. So it's called Looking Over My Shoulder. I went to heaven once. Sadly leaving my push mower and orange snow shovel behind, like uneaten food pushed aside on a stark china plate. The man upstairs was not happy. He liked a sharp blade and a clear driveway. His strictures were stringent enough to shrive a cactus. Yet it was I who blindly insisted on formalities and stood on what I thought was ceremony. I could scarcely taste the beer he poured or eat my ham sandwich. When our visit was over, he shook my hand and sent me somersaulting back to my village, where I was filled, thank God, with genuine salt.
Don Scher, thank you.
I have met my maker, and now, John, I have met you. Not necessarily in that order.
I really appreciate you coming on New Books and Poetry.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This was a great, great conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Me too.